Greetings again to all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph. We're now in lesson 122. And last time we're in verse 18 of Exodus 12, speaking about the Passover, the timing of the Passover and the days of unleavened bread, which are the same day. Both begin on the same day. In the 14th, that is in the first month, on the 14th day of the month at even. That's when they kill the Passover. And also in the first month, in verse 18 as we read, on the 14th day of the month at even, you shall eat unleavened bread until the 1 and 20th day of the month at even. And God, you know, God made it very plain here through Moses. And people just went to Moses. They had simple understanding. It was not that difficult to understand. But people that departed from that, it's just like Abraham in that parable, you know, says to the rich man, the parable of Lazarus and the rich man, he said, look, you know, they've got Moses. See, they're not willing to listen to Moses. And people like that who are not willing to listen to Moses, he says, though one rises from the dead, they're not going to listen to him either. That's what the problem is. And unfortunately, so-called Christianity was not willing to listen to Moses. And another false religion appeared on the scene called Islam, and they were not willing to listen to Moses. So both were inventing their own religions, you know, with a mixture of some of the truth. And each one of them thinks, well, we know better. And unfortunately, many of us coming out of that, you know, in the majority of cases, you know, we come out of so-called Christianity, and so we bring that state of mind and attitude there with us, you know, then we impose it on the Bible, you see, on matters that oftentimes we do not even understand because we have no understanding even of the language to begin with. And then we go to those who have been raised on that, who know the culture and the language, and for that matter, even if you go to a non, you know, non-Israelite, you know, non-Jew, you go to an Arab, he can tell you exactly also what these words mean, because those are Semitic languages, and they're similar. As a matter of fact, when Jews want to know, nowadays, scholars, archaeologists, how certain words in Hebrew were understood at the time, they go to modern Arabic, because modern Arabic and ancient Arabic are still the same, you see, and they still preserve the same knowledge and understanding and meaning of those words. And so we, unfortunately, many in our midst have rejected that, and without realizing it, they were rejecting Moses. And when you reject Moses, you reject God. And when God makes it very plain here, he's speaking here, not Moses. Moses is just recording it. And so when he says, remember the law of Moses, my servant, he also says, which I commanded to him. So we're not talking about Mosaic law. You see, only the ignorance among Christianity invented this concept. Well, we're talking about Mosaic law. In other words, oh, that's Mosaic. It's not godly. It's not Christian. There's no such a thing, Mosaic law. God is the one that gave it to him. What do you mean Mosaic law? A lot of people say, well, okay, you know, Moses may have said that, but, you know, but we've got Christ, you know, we follow him. Well, Moses is the one speaking to Christ, and Christ is the one speaking to Moses. And Christ is the one that says, you better obey the law that I gave to Moses. I, Jesus Christ. An awful lot of ignorance out there, unfortunately. And here's Jesus Christ speaking. And therefore, when he was crucified on the right day, on the day that the sacrifice itself was being killed by the priest, he was being killed. And there we read very plainly in the Gospels the exact time when he was killed, when he died. 3 o'clock. You see, between 3 and 6. And then, you know, he was there from 9 o'clock in the morning, the third hour, and around 3 o'clock, basically, that's the time when they killed the Passover. And he was killed. I was on time. It was on the, you know, on the first month, on the 14th day at even, 3 o'clock. That's what even means, you see, because remember, there are two evenings. And so he said, again, verse 18, in the first month, on the 14th day of the month, at even, you shall eat unleavened bread until the 1 and 20th day of the month at even. 7 days with the Passover. That's when they ate the first unleavened bread. And that's when the days of unleavened bread began, with the Passover. You see? But it was killed. You see? It was killed before the 14th day. You see? But it was eaten on the 14th day. But then the even, when you look at this terminology, you might say that it was killed on the 14th day also, because the even begins at that time. There are two evenings between 3 to real sunset. That's when the evening is. between the two evenings, you know, the first evening, the second evening. So technically, you might say it was Tuesday, you know, the end of Tuesday, and it was the beginning of Wednesday. And still it is the within, you know, the terminology of the 14th, because there are two evenings there. And because people did not understand all that, obviously they have had a problem. But, you know, had they looked to Moses, if they did not understand the first one, verse 18 would have made it very plain when that was. When is it that they had the Passover, and when is it that the days of unleavened bread begun? The same time. First month, on the 14th day of the month, at even. You see? Not the day after that. And he said, you shall eat unleavened bread until the 120th day of the month at even. 7 days shall there be no leaven found in your houses, for whosoever eats that which is leavened, that soul shall be cut off from the congregation of Israel, whether it be a sojourner or one that is born in the land. It didn't make any difference to God. You don't bring leaven to my land during that time. You see, you want to be a sojourner? Go somewhere else. Take a vacation during that time and eat your bread wherever you want. But you know, I'm not going to eat in my land. Because the whole land symbolically had to be purified from sin during that period of time. And God was intolerant about that. He said, I'm going to kill you. Literally. If you defile my land during that period of time and bring sin in. You know, obviously it's all that symbolic. But that was a lesson. And he made it very plain. That for 7 days, and he said it, actually when you read it in the scriptures, about seven times, you know, these are the occasions that I saw it in the Bible, seven times God says, you shall eat unleavened bread for 7 days. Not whenever you feel like it, as some in their ignorance and still doing to this very day, and they call themselves, you know, spiritual teachers. You don't make a choice about it. God says you've got 7 days, on every single one of those days, you eat unleavened bread whether you like it or not. And some people say, oh, now, this is not what he meant. He just meant that, you know, if you eat, you know, if you want to eat bread, make sure it's unleavened bread. So you can do it only twice during that period, or maybe only once. And God made it very plain. Again and again and again, 7 times. You know, are we hard of hearing? That 7 times are not enough for us to believe what God says. You see, good understanding have all those that do His commandments, and the people that do not do His commandments are the ones that came up with His teaching, as they should. You know, so they're ignorant, and then they pass on their blindness to others, and they all fall into the same ditch. Well, God made it very plain. 7 days you eat unleavened bread, and 7 days unleavened bread should not be in your houses and throughout the land, because the sojourners were not allowed to have it either, or eat it. And verse 20, you shall eat nothing leavened. In all your habitations shall you eat unleavened bread. You shall, you see, eat. Not whenever you feel like it, but for 7 days, he said. Unless you want to fast for 3 days in between for whatever reason, you know, that's a different story. Or one day, then on that day you didn't eat it. But generally speaking, when you eat, every day, which you do every day and 3 times a day, make sure you have unleavened bread there, because there is a purpose for it, a symbolic purpose. Verse 21, then Moses called for all the elders of Israel and said unto them, draw out and take you lambs according to your families and kill the Passover lamb. And you shall take a bunch of hyssop and dip it. And hyssop was had spiritual connotation, as later on you would read about David in Psalm 51. He said, purge me with hyssop. And that thing has been used for ages before that and still to this very day in societies that understand what hyssop is. It's a purifier. And a lot of certain things, anyway, by some vitamins. I'm taking some kind of a supplement called Respi-11 for respiratory. Basically what it means, I don't take it for respiratory, but it is for purifying the blood. It keeps your blood pure, and it has hyssop in it. And so that's what it's talking about here. Take a bunch of hyssop, because of that purifying concept that is in it, and dip it in the blood that is in the basin and strike the lintel. So even the thing that you are going to use to take the blood, you see, which is going to be symbolizing the pure blood of Jesus Christ without sin, without blemish, that very thing that you use to dip the blood in must also be something with the same connotation. It has to be pure, because hyssop has a purifying quality in purifying the blood. Therefore, you use hyssop. So you cannot use just anything you want. So all this symbolism is extremely important, because that points toward the ultimate sacrifice, And God was very particular about all these matters. And so he said, you take a bunch of hyssop and you dip it in the blood that is in the basin and strike the lintel and the two sides posts. And so three areas that you do with the blood that is in the basin. And none of you shall go out of the door of his house until the morning. Now here again, some people have this controversy about it. Well, no, they couldn't go until the morning. And yet, you know, later on it says that they left by night in the morning. And again, they don't understand terminology and idioms of the time. And they do not even consider their own terminology. You know, they were objective, they would have understood it. You know, you go home, you say good night. Well, it's not good night, it's only 5 o'clock. So what do you say good night or good evening? And you get up in the morning, 1 o'clock in the morning, you say, well, I got up 1 o'clock in the morning. Well, if it's night, what do you call it morning? Well, it's a terminology. So in essence, in that way, you know, things have not changed. And people get all mixed up about it and have endless debates, all these things, and totally misunderstand it. And they don't know the right from the wrong, their left. And they pass it on, misunderstanding to others, you know, claiming that they, you know, they have spiritual knowledge and understanding that God gave them. It's confusion. That's Babylon. God says, come out of Babylon. The word of God is very simple. You know, the simplicity in Christ is not complex, is not confusing to people, and you don't need to write many articles. Just read what it says. You see? And then you get the point. And so he said, you don't leave your home until the morning. But, you know, morning could be what? Could be morning when the daylight is totally there. It could be 9 o'clock in the morning, 10 o'clock in the morning, 11 o'clock in the morning, you know, 1 minute before 12 in the morning. Or it could be 1 o'clock at night, which is also you call the morning. As soon as midday or midnight pass, you are into the next day. You know, technically speaking, so you can use the terminology both ways. And for the Lord, he says, shall pass through to smite the Egyptians. And when did he pass? At midnight. And immediately after midnight, technically, that's morning. And we understand it to this very day. And so we say, well, I woke up at, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning. And so he said, the Lord shall pass through to smite the Egyptians. And when he sees the blood upon the lintel, so he's personally going to do it. And he's going to be there. It's not an angel. And we talk about the angel of the Lord later on. It was him. And so when he sees the blood upon the lintel and all the two side posts, the Lord will pass over the door. It's the Lord who is going to pass over the door. You see? So he's keeping, you know, he repeats it again and again and again and again. I am the one doing it. I am the one seeing it. I am the one smiting. I am the one passing on. I am the one that is passing over your sins. This is symbolic by the blood that purifies them, which later on would symbolize my own. And again, you know, his own blood and the blood of the Lamb were both physical. Both made of the same components. So in that sense, there is no difference. That's what the blood of animals can substitute for the blood of men. Blood is blood. You see? And so he says, I will pass over the door and will not suffer the destroyer to come in to your houses to smite you. You see, he's not going to allow the destruction to come on you. And he's not talking about somebody else who's going to do it. He himself is going to be involved in the process. Now, if he has angels coming with him, well, they're coming with him. But himself is involved in the process. And you shall observe this thing for an ordinance to you and to your sons forever. You see, you observe this ordinance of the blood. And you remember it. And it's not something that you do every single year necessarily. In terms of the, you know, you lived in the tent, they didn't do it in the tent. And then when they went to the feast, you see, when you went to the feast, well, you couldn't do it for your home. You see, you're away from home. So you understand it, you know, what he's talking about here. You know, you observe this thing as an ordinance forever, but you understand also the changes that would, you know, were made down the road. If all Israel is going to go to Jerusalem for the Passover, they obviously cannot do it on their own door because they're not there, they're not home. So what does that mean? Now, you know, well, symbolically the high priest does it there for all of Israel on the temple. And those who lived in Jerusalem, they could have done it on their homes, you see, but the rest of Israel could not. So understand also the changes that took place there. And so he said, you shall observe this thing for an ordinance to you, and especially, you know, if you went to Jerusalem, you lived in a hotel, you certainly couldn't do it for the hotel. You know, the head of the owner of the hotel could have done it, you couldn't do it. So, you know, we have to understand those things too within the law. And you shall observe this thing for an ordinance for you and to your sons forever, and it shall come to pass when you come to the land which the Lord will give you, according as he has promised, that you shall keep this service. So they continued to do it wherever they could. But mind you, if they left home and they went, you see, to Jerusalem, and there they killed the Passover, then obviously they couldn't do it in their home. But when they went to Jerusalem, whatever they, you know, could be done there, that was done, as I mentioned, either in the temple, that couldn't be done, or if you were in a house there and the owner of the house did it, or if you stayed with your relatives there or friends or whatever it may be. But obviously, you know, if you just stayed in a tent, you know, you cannot do it in a tent because that was didn't have a door. So, you know, this law has to be understood within the context also. And so he says in verse 26, and it shall come to pass, when your children shall say unto you, what mean you by this service? That you shall say, it is a sacrifice of the Lord's Passover, for that he had passed over the houses of the children of Israel in Egypt. So they go into the land of Israel, and they do it there too, you know, wherever they can, based on all circumstances. You go to the temple, it is done there. You go to the tabernacle, and I don't know what structure it was where they could do it there. You couldn't do it on the tent, because then you can't wash it after that. But, you know, you do it on doorposts where you can wash it after that. But, you know, on a fabric, that's a different story. So obviously you have to take into account, you know, the changes there in terms of where you lived, where you went for the feast and all that stuff. And then you'll understand it better. And so it says, well, when you go through that, you know, be it in Shiloh in Jerusalem, the kids will ask you, well, what is it all about? And so I explain to him, it is the Lord's Passover, for he passed over the houses of the children of Israel in Egypt, when he smote the Egyptians and delivered our houses, and the people bowed the head and worshipped. So, basically, bow down all the way to the ground, as the custom is still today, as you see it in the Muslim community. They bow down all the way to the ground, and the Jews do it only once a year on the Day of Atonement. And not all of them do it. The Orthodox still do it, bow down all the way to the ground. That's the only time. And so that's what it means to bow down, totally, all the way down to the ground, with your face to the ground. And they worship God. And that's the very word also, to bow down, is linked with that, lishtachavot, to worship. And you cannot do it, lishtachavot, unless you bow down. So the Jews in the synagogue still do it, but not all the way when they pray. That's the reason why you see them constantly, you know, bending down, especially when they mention the name of God or certain things like that. Verse 28, and the children of Israel went and did so, as the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron, so they did. You know, they didn't invent their own ideas or concepts, exactly what he told them, and so they did. So they killed it on the Passover, on the 14th day, and they ate the unleavened bread on the 14th day, and they both were at the same time, and they followed instructions. And, you know, it's something important for us to remember that when we worship God, that's the way we do it. And then we continue in verse 29, and it came to pass at midnight that the Lord, so he's the one who is involved personally in that the Lord, Jehovah, smote all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh that sat on his throne, so he began with him, and unto the firstborn of the captive, even the slaves, in other words, everybody across the board, high and low. The captive that was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of cattle. And Pharaoh rose up in the night. Now, they already knew that this is going to happen, so obviously they were prepared for it. And to whatever degree all the Egyptians knew, we don't know, of that edict that Moses pronounced on Egypt, and yet the household of Pharaoh knew it, and so it says they rose up in the night, he and all his servants, and all the Egyptians. Now, it does not mean they were asleep all this time. Obviously, they were awake to see what was going to happen. After all, the servants of Pharaoh, and Pharaoh himself by now, had seen that every time Moses said that something is going to happen, it did happen exactly when he said. So, they were all prepared for it, to see whether it's going to happen. And you can imagine at this time, the servants must have been pretty angry at Pharaoh, who could have prevented that, and they realized that they too are going to pay the penalty, but what could they do? And so it was a very traumatized scene there that you see. And so when it says rose up, it does not necessarily mean that they were asleep. They just all got up from their beds, you know, wondering when it is going to happen. And so they went and obviously checked their children, and they found a dead person here, a dead person there. A wife could turn around and her husband is dead, and or children, or whatever it may be. And so that's what we read. And Pharaoh rose up in the night, and he and all of his servants and all the Egyptians, you see, all of them, to one degree or the other, at least around Goshen, they immediately knew about this edict. And then that word, you know, spread throughout all the entirety of Egypt. And they too experienced that very calamity, and so they all rose up. And there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house, imagine that, not one single house where there was not one dead, at least one. So some houses could have been, you know, with several dead people. You know, the husband could have been a firstborn, and then his son a firstborn, and they're all gone, and then the cattle, you know, they had sheep and goats and things like that. And so they're going to find dead people all around and dead cattle. And he called, that is Pharaoh, for Moses and Aaron by night. Now what's by night? Midnight already passed, you see, and they're all looking around, and they're all weeping, and they're all crying, and you know, they're going through through this emotional fiasco that they're going through there at this point. And midnight is over, so now you can say anytime after midnight it's morning, but it's also night. And so when you read the terminology here by night, it could be both ways. And Aaron, Moses were summoned to him by night, and he said to them, "Rise up, get you forth from among my people." In other words, you're not going to stick around for the whole night. Just get out of this place, you know, right now, at this moment. And that's what he means by that. You know, don't even stick around until the morning. And that's, mind you, it's right past midnight. Could have been about this point, 12:30 or 1 o'clock, depending on how long it took them to do it. You know, call on Pharaoh. That is, Pharaoh is calling on Moses and Aaron. Then Moses and Aaron have to make it all the way there, you know, walking over there. And obviously they're not too far. But, you know, this could have been about 1 o'clock at this point, or even 2 o'clock. And he basically tells him, right, you know, at this moment, you all get up. You're not going to stay in Egypt tonight anymore. You're going to get out right now. And so that's what he says, "Rise up, get you forth from among my people, both you and the children of Israel, and go, serve the Lord as you have said. Take both your flocks and your herds as you have said, and be gone." That's something he'd never said before about the flocks and the herds. And I said, you know, anything you want to do it, and just get out of here. And then he adds, "And bless me also." So he's in a very distressed state of mind, but also in a repentant, at least to a degree here, and acknowledging the supremacy of the God of Moses and of Israel, and so he's even asking for a blessing. And that's quite a turn of events, and God brought him to this very point, where he would actually turn around and ask God to bless him. In verse 33, now the Egyptians also get into the action, and the Egyptians were urgent upon the people to send them out of the land in haste. For they said, "We are all dead men." So you think they're going to let them stick around for another whole day, you know, as a false doctrine, you know, that many have been taught for quite a while. Imagine that, if you live in that time, in that land, and you have all those dead people and dead cattle all around the place, you're not going to let people stick around for a whole day, because, you know, they were so superstitious at the same time, they didn't realize who was going to be next. So their life was at stake. And when people's lives are at stake, you see, they take action. And they're not going to wait around and say, "Okay, no problem, just hang around for another day in Egypt." That certainly was not the case. And the account is very plain, the way it happened, and yet we totally rejected it, at least many of us in a certain organization, blinded our eyes, we're not willing to accept it, and we went about inventing our own doctrine, and then we're blaming other groups and organizations and religions for doing the same, which is pathetic. And so this is what the Egyptians are doing here. They're very urgent, and they tell them, "Get out in haste," just like God told them. That's why he told them to be ready. I'm literally ready, with your suitcase packed, so to speak. Your hat is on your head, and your coat is over, not so you can hang around, you know, for another whole day. And it's at this point that the Egyptians, as they came to urge them, whatever they wore. In those days, as it is in these days, also in India and many other places like that, people literally wear their riches on themselves, you know, bracelets and chains and all kind of things like that. So when they came over to them, and, you know, they had earrings and nose rings and all those things, they just took advantage of it, the Israelites, knowing what was going to happen anyway, being prepared in advance. And just told the Egyptians, "You want me to get out, you know, give me this, you know, and give me that, and give me your robe, and give me your coat." And so, that's what happened right at this moment. And the Egyptians were urgent upon the people to send them out of the land in haste, for they said, "We are all dead men." At this point, you don't argue about, you know, your bracelet and your earrings or whatever you have. You just give it up. And the people took their dough before it was leavened, you see. Had they had a whole day, as was thought, erroneously, obviously the leaven would have become bread. But the dough, in other words, the dough would have been leavened, but the dough didn't have time to be leavened because they were thrust out. You know, that's another very, very plain statement and clear understanding. And you see, that's what happens, unfortunately, from the days of old. And people do not believe Moses. They don't believe God. You know, they believe their own pet theories, and they're going to twist the scriptures to fit those pet theories that they have. They may have a lot of understanding in other areas, but in some points, in other words, any time we set an idol before us, that idol is going to be a stumbling block before us. And a pet theory is an idol. And so we're going to change everything and protect that idol, and we're going to twist the scriptures, and we're going to pervert the scriptures, we're going to go to any length to maintain that idol. And that's what many have done, that's what many are still doing to this very day in many areas. And the whole process here that God brought upon Egypt and executed on Egypt and their gods, and to teach also the children of Israel, is that you shall not have other gods before me. Look what happens to them when you do. They all crumble and are destroyed and wiped out and crushed, and they cannot deliver you. And so this is what is happening here. The leaven, that is the dough, doesn't have enough time to rise, because they throw them out. They don't leave them, you know, there for another day. And so it says, the people took the dough before it was leavened, and their knitting trousers being bound up in their clothes upon their shoulders. So they were already ready for that. You know, even in all the things that they cook with, they were already packed on the shoulders. And as they go along the way, you know, this dough is going to rise. But they could not stay in Egypt. You see, that was the end of it, the end of the captivity. And the children of Israel, and then you find also, if you can mention here, when Jesus Christ mentioned the very thing, that when he brings deliverance to his people, he does not want people, as you read in Matthew and other places, to just look back. He doesn't want them to go back to the roof and say, oh, I forgot something there, or go back to the house, I forgot something there. He said, just take off. When that time comes, you just take off, leave everything behind, and, oh, don't worry about it, God is going to take care of you. You see? And so, they were totally prepared. And there was no reason for them to stick around for another whole day, because the Egyptians came to them. And to begin with, they had also a lot of the Egyptians in their neighborhood and those who lived in their own homes. Servants or slaves or whatever it may be. Or maybe even owners of the houses, you know, whether they were renting, or who knows what circumstances are. But they certainly did not go all over Egypt and, you know, wasting a whole day looking for riches. All came to them. That's the reason God told them, just get out. Don't wait at that point. Be totally prepared and ready. And when the word comes, they take off. You see? And when we, you know, disregard that, and then we invent, you know, one night is the Passover, and then a whole day in between, and then after that, you know, comes the day of unleavened bread, you know, the beginning of the feast, when so far, even before that, the scripture was already made very plain that the very moment that you begin to eat the Passover is also the time that you begin the days of unleavened bread, on the 14th at even, both of them. Now, that was not good enough for some people, so they had to come to this point and, you know, begin to argue about Ben Arbaim and what it means, and whether it was night or morning when they left, you know, and all the stories, and the fact that Moses was told by Pharaoh, you're not going to see me, you see, and so forth and so forth, and all kind of stories like that. And he, you know, the fact that he told Israel, you don't leave the house until morning. And so he said, well, morning means 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, something like that, or 7 o'clock in the morning. Why not 1 o'clock? You see, that's morning too. 1 in the morning or 1 at night. It could go both ways. And there again, you know, when people do not have their eyes on God, but on their own, lean to their own understanding, well, that's what happens. And so the children of Israel, verse 35, did according to the word of Moses. See? They listened to Moses. We did not. And when we don't listen to Moses, when we don't obey Moses, when we do not study Moses and see what God said through him, that's in essence what we are doing when we study Moses. We're not studying a man, we're studying what God told him. Well, obviously we go astray. And so They did, according to the word of Moses. And they asked for the Egyptians jewels of silver and jewels of gold. And this is the specific statement here about doing according to the word of Moses. Moses told them in advance, when they come to you, they're going to throw you out. Take advantage of that point. At this point, they don't care about riches. They don't care about money. They don't care about jewels. They don't care about their clothes. They don't care about anything. They just want to be alive. That's the advantage, you see, for us. Take advantage of that very moment, you know, when their mind is not at all on any physical thing, but on their own very lives, their own children. That's when he asked them, okay, you want me out, give me this and give me that. And that's exactly what they did. And that was the instruction of God to Moses, to Israel. And so this is what they did. And they asked the Egyptians jewels of silver, jewels of gold, and raiment, their own clothes. They took, you know, their clothes. It's not that the Egyptians came with their wardrobe, you see. They just took their own robes from, you know, and their coats, whatever they had on, especially when they wake up at night, you know, it's cold, so you put on something. They just took it away from them. That's all there was to it. And so they took their raiment too. And the Lord gave the people, on top of that, the Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they let them have what they asked. So on top of the fact that they were totally traumatized and they were not thinking about any physical things, on top of that, God put it in their hearts to just be willing to give anything and everything, just as long as the, you know, Israelites just take off that very moment. And so we read here, and they asked, that is, and this despoiled the Egyptians. You know, just like you go into somebody's home and just take everything. And the people are so scared, they just let you have anything you want as long as you spare their lives. Well, that's the case, you know, the Egyptians at this point. And the children of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot. And people read that in their ignorance and blindness. Again, no context, no background, no understanding, no wisdom, no study of the word, no going deeper into it and say, aha, that's how many Israelites were, 600,000 on foot. That's not what it said here. It's a 600,000 men, but how about women and children and elderly, you see? How about later on when you read the number of the children of Israel as they were counted, this is the number that you come up with, that only the men from 20 to 50 were 600,000. That did not include all the others. And the number, who knows? Nobody knows exactly their number. If you just figure out, you know, that those people were extremely prolific with many children, obviously, you end up with a few millions, you know, at least 3, 4, or 5 millions. And could not even be 2 million, as some say, you know. It's impossible for 600,000 men, you know, to be only with the children and elderly and wives and so forth, to be only 2 million. The ratio is certainly much higher than that when you have big families, not little, but big ones. And so that's what it says here, in 600,000 men on foot beside children. And of course it meant also beside women, beside elderly and so forth. Verse 38, and a mixed multitude went up also with them. Now what was happening during all this time, the punishment that was coming upon Egypt, you know, was driving home into the minds and hearts of many Egyptians and also slaves among them. That's why it says mixed multitude, otherwise could have said just Egyptians. But there were a lot of slaves in Egypt. Egypt was a conquering empire, and they had a lot of slaves, and people that they were from all over the place, and people that came to Egypt because life was much better there than other places, you know, just like in today's Americas. And so the mixed multitude is of all nations that were there. You know, there would have been Canaanites and Ethiopians and, you know, people from just all over the Middle East and other places. And those are the mixed multitude that were convinced. Still totally carnal, you know, they were not spiritual. But to one degree or the other, you know, they had the fear of God, they saw all these things, and, you know, carnal-minded people, they see all these calamities, and they say, surely this must be God, and especially when they're idol worshippers to begin with. And so they're, you know, in their own mind, they're exchanging one idol for another. Not a real personal relationship with a divine being who is a spirit being, but, you know, that natural, carnal-minded attitude. Well, this God is not big enough for me, I like this one better. And so this mixed multitude, you know, with this in mind, and maybe some of them were a little bit more humble and really feared God and continued to obey God no matter what. But we're going to read a few more things about this mixed multitude later on that created problems among the Israelites. And the mixed multitude went up also with them, and flocks and herds, even very much cattle. Now, a lot of these things the Egyptians gave them, you know, all those who lived in their neighborhoods. But on the other hand, also the Israelites had their own cattle, just like we read before that. The cattle of Egypt was smitten many ways, but the cattle of Israel was not. So here, as we mentioned earlier, this is not the concept of slavery that you found, let's say, in modern history, let's say in the United States. that kind of slavery where, you know, the slave just had nothing and the master owned everything. Now, these are slaves that own property. They own their homes. They own their own cattle, you know, own herds, you know, a lot of those things, and they were taking care of them. And just the men that were taken, you know, into hard labor without pay. But the Israelites were certainly not in that kind of captivity that people think that it was. And many of the other captivities that came upon Israel was the same thing, you know, where they were taken into captivity, and well, they went with all their flocks with them. And after all, you know, the enemy is not interested in feeding them, so they're going to let them, you know, take their own flocks and their own herds and, you know, let them feed themselves and take care of themselves. And that's basically the way it was. So that was not to their advantage to take away from them their flocks and their herds, and they'll have to feed them. And they were not interested in that. So they moved them to other areas, as the Assyrians have done, and they said, you know, we'll take you to places where they have vineyards and plants and, you know, and all kind of things like that. And you just mind your own business as long as you don't rebel against the king of Assyria. And okay, the king Nebuchadnezzar had done the same. When they came to Egypt, he gave them lands. And Jeremiah told them, well, plant vineyards and just business as usual. You're in captivity, that means away from your land. That's what the concept of captivity is, away from your land. Exile, that's what it means. You are exiled from your land. A lot of people today living in exile doesn't mean they, you know, they are slaves. Well, you know, somebody bought them and they're in that condition. So let's understand what slavery we're talking about here. And then when we come to the section of slavery in the scriptures later on, we're going to understand again what that slavery was all about. It's not what we think, and we should never compare it to what happened here in this country with the slaves that were brought from Africa and other places. That's a totally different concept of it. And so it says, you know, that they came with all that riches that they had and the baked unleavened cakes of the dough which they brought forth out of Egypt. You see? So they had no time for the leaven. Leaven doesn't, you know, need that many hours. But even that, they didn't have any of that, because as soon as midnight was over, the Egyptians were up, you know, and about. And certainly the Egyptians that lived in their midst knew exactly at midnight what happened. And they were the first, you know, to come and chase them out of the country. Just like God said, you know, they will literally, you know, he used the word legaresh, which means they will chase you out of the country. They literally went after them and said, you know, get out of here. Just move, 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 move. You see, and that's the way it was. So they certainly, you know, couldn't bake their bread, and so on the way they were doing it. And they baked unleavened cakes of the dough which they brought forth out of Egypt, for it was not leavened. Because they were thrust, again, God is making it very obvious, and he's emphasizing that, they were thrust, they were thrown out of Egypt, and could not tarry. They could not stick around for another day. So you see, the scriptures are very plain, that when people, you know, set an idol before their eyes, they can't see the truth anymore, and yet we think, you know, just like Paul said, those people who think that they stand, take heed, lest you fall. And many people have fell for that foolishness. And many of them are still believing it to this very day, unfortunately. They have got eyes, but they cannot see, and ears, but they cannot hear, and a heart, but they cannot understand, and they think they are doing great. So that's a description of Laodicean people, and we've been that for years, and prided ourselves on being better than others, in our folly. And so they were thrust out of Egypt and could not tarry, neither had they prepared for themselves any victual. That means, you know, there was no time for anything. You see, that's midnight, you know, they were eating their Passover, and obviously they knew what was coming, so they were awake. They didn't go to sleep. You know, the children may have fallen asleep, and some of them got real tired. But, you know, the excitement of the living of Egypt certainly is not going to allow anybody to be asleep. So they were right there prepared, ready, you know. And as soon as that happened, and they heard those screams and yells and cries of the children of Egypt, they were ready. So there was no time to prepare even provisions, you know, take on the road. That's how they were thrown out. So for us to come around and invent that day in between, you know, to justify our ignorance and our pit theory, you know, the Passover happened on one night and the Day of Unleavened Bread happened on the next night, well, it shows us how ignorant we are. And so he says, you know, that neither they prepared for themselves any victual. Now the time that the children of Israel dwelt in Egypt, you see, and this statement throws an awful lot of people for a loop. The time that the children of Israel dwelt in Egypt was 430 years. Now, what does that mean, 430 years? Everybody reads that, well, on the surface, that's the way it looks. They've been in Egypt in slavery, or at least in Egypt, 430 years. It's supposedly from the time that Jacob and his family went down to Egypt. This is not what it's saying here. You see, you have to understand what the scripture says and what the scripture means. And that's where many people fall and stumble, and the wise only shall understand. You see, we went through that earlier, so I'm not going to spend much time on that, just briefly saying that there were only a few generations there. And Moses, for example, when you check his genealogy, he was the eighth from Abraham. You see, only eight generations from between him and Abraham. And then you read also in chapter 6 that you have a little genealogy there of the people of Israel that came to Egypt, and specific, God is putting the emphasis on Levi. And basically, we are told very plainly that when Israel came to Egypt, they came, you know, with all their, that is, the whole family was about 70, and Jacob was there, and his son Levi. And so in chapter 6 and verse 16, we read about Levi. And these are the names of the sons of Levi according to their generations, Gershon and Kohat and Merari. Now Kohat is what we're interested in, that's the son of Levi. And the years of Levi were 137 years, so he lived 137 years, you see. And when he came, Joseph was already 39, and Levi was at least about 10 years, probably even more than, a little bit more than that, than Joseph. So let's say he was about 49 or 50, you know, sometimes in the early 50s, and lived 137 years. So for 87 years, you see, they were not in captivity, they were not in slavery, they were still with their former dynasty and doing very well. Because when Joseph died, it says that he and all of his brothers died and still were in charge of the land. So obviously for that period of time, 87 years, nothing happens. And so Levi dies at 137, and he has three sons. And the son of Kohat, which is the son of Levi, or Levi. So we are talking about the grandson of Jacob, Kohat, was the father of Amram, the father of Moses. So how long is that? That's not long, you see. That's a very short time when you think about it. And at the most, we probably have been there. We can calculate the time. I think I've done it earlier, so I'm not going to go through that now. That's not the point, just a minor point here. But could not have been there more than 200 years, or 210, I think I figured that out a while back. About 210 years. And that included the good times that they had there. Because you see, you count actually from the days of Abraham. When God gave the covenant to Abraham, that's when the story began. And the mere fact that Canaan was under the dominion of Egypt, therefore that terminology could be taken to mean that. That they lived in that, under the domain and the influence of Egypt all these years, even though they may have been in the land of Canaan. You see? And so when you read the scripture here about the period of time that they were there, obviously it's going to be a little bit confusing for people, and they're not going to fully comprehend that. And the period of the slavery itself, the hard bondage, probably must have been the most about 90 years. Not more than that, maybe even 100 years. You see, Moses, when he was born, and, you know, he was with Egypt, and his people were already in slavery. And so then he fled, and then he came back when he was 80. Well, anyway, we're going to stop at this point. Continue next time. This is again Mordecai Joseph. Greetings to all of God's people.